Good afternoon, and welcome to the Commerce Committee for March 11th, 2020. We do have a quorum, and looking to see if somebody has had a chance to peruse the minutes from March 10th. I'm going to entertain a motion.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move the minutes of March 10th.
Representative Davids moves the minutes of March 10th for approval. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails, and the minutes are approved. The first bill on the agenda is mine, so I'm going to make my way up.
First bill is mine.
Do you want to, or do you have to go do a bill?
At the end, I'm fine.
Okay.
Chair Halverson, do you want to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 4042 be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety.
And I understand you have an amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the A1 author's amendment.
Representative Halverson moves the A1 amendment, which gets the bill in the shape she'd like the committee to consider it. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion carries. Amendment's adopted, and the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. This bill deals with fraudulent business filings. It's a problem that the Secretary of State's office is seeing in greater numbers, and I would say with greater creativity based on our conversations. It is a deep behind-the-scenes function of the Office of the Secretary of State, and I would like to turn it over to the Secretary to introduce the bill and explain what it does.
Secretary Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Halverson. I really appreciate it, and thank you, members, for your time and attention. Usually when I testify, it's on elections bills in the election-related committees, but this is different. I'm here before the Commerce Committee to ask that members help our office cut down on commercial fraud by cutting down on the incidents and perhaps even eliminating the filing of bogus liens. It's a problem, not just in Minnesota, but it's a problem that's growing nationwide, so I'll explain that in a minute. The biggest part of our office by headcount is not elections. The biggest part of our office is business services. It's not done here in the state office building. It's done about eight blocks away on Empire Drive, and many of you are personally, through your other day jobs, familiar with what we do there. One of the things that we do is we accept filings under the Uniform Commercial Code, or UCC, for liens. Those who have a security interest in an instrument that proves that. So these are legal notices that are filed with our office that the filer is a debtor and has a security interest against a creditor of some kind. So in some senses, as to that kind of filing, we're like a filing cabinet. People come either in person at our counter or online in some instances, depending on the transaction, and we file whatever the person gives us after carefully reviewing it to redact any nine-digit number that could be a Social Security number. But other than that, we don't have authority right now, and most states don't. We don't have authority to look at something that is pretty obviously a fraudulent filing and stop it. So there's no pre-filing remedy. The only remedies are post-filing. So this wouldn't be a problem if we didn't routinely and in growing numbers receive clearly fraudulent business filings, but we do. So here's an example, and these are real-world examples. Picture in Minnesota an offender at a correctional facility or an unhappy constituent who places a lien against a correctional officer or a legislator or a public official for $100,000, for $1 million, for $1 billion. As silly as that sounds, that has been done in Minnesota. So not only is that filing now public information, but these bogus liens actually cause actual problems for people when they go to buy a home or make some sort of other major purchase and suddenly find that they have a bunch of liens on them that are phony and that are fraudulent. So those are the retaliatory or harassment kinds of liens. And some of you may remember a few years ago in Hennepin County, both Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman and then Hennepin County Sheriff Rich Stanek were victims of this. There were people disgruntled with actions they had taken that filed millions and millions of dollars of phony and fraudulent liens on them. And it took some doing to get those off. But those are just the retaliatory or harassment liens. There's a whole different species of fraudulent or bogus liens. And those are the kinds that are sometimes called straw man filings. So if you're familiar, as some of you may be, with the sovereign citizen movement, this is a movement in Minnesota and all over the country that has some pretty offbeat and strange theories about the world. And this is one of their signature moves. So one of the things that they believe, many of them, is that all Americans, when we're born, for all Americans, the federal government creates a straw man account at the U.S. Treasury Department representing the monetary worth of each citizen. Sometimes they claim it's, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars. Sometimes they claim it's millions of dollars. They then believe that a UCC filing statement with our office allows them to secure an interest in their straw man account and gain access to this secret account that is holding these funds. We've been briefed, and some of you may know about the activities of these sovereign citizen movements, and in one briefing, one person in our office reported that the FBI told her, if these theories make sense to you, there's something wrong. That's really the kind of folks that we're dealing with here. It doesn't make sense. You can't get your arms around it. They have their own really bizarre theories. So this may seem like a relatively harmless filing, the one that I just talked about. No one gets hurt. Seems like a victimless crime, not the retaliatory kind, but this kind. But the problem is what we found in our conversations with law enforcement nationwide and in Minnesota, the FBI in particular, and the Attorney General's office, is that the straw man filing is often just a foundational document. So they get that in there. No one flags it because, sure, it's silly, but no one gets hurt by that. And then they use that as the foundational document for all sorts of other fraud, including mortgage fraud and potentially other retaliatory and harassment filings. So here are some real-world examples from Minnesota that we have received that clearly indicate a fraudulent business filing or lien filing. One is the same name is listed under both debtor and secured party. Some of these filings have a red ink thumbprint that is meant to represent some sort of blood oath under the doctrines of some of these groups. Sometimes we have a hugely excessive number of pages filed. These filings should be no more than 1 to 3 pages. Sometimes people come in with hundreds of pages. Sometimes they use additional fake designations in front of party names that make no sense. Sometimes there's a lack of a physical address. Sometimes there are extraneous references to the Bible, to the Constitution, to foreign treaties, none of which have anything to do with this whatsoever. Sometimes there are disproportionately large dollar amounts on the collateral. One Department of Corrections employee had a lien filed against him for $3 billion, billion with a B. And some of the signatures are followed by the words sovereign living soul. Sovereign living soul, to indicate members of the sovereign citizen movement. And sometimes we get copies of personal documents like birth certificates or Social Security cards that are included in the filing. Again, not a requirement, not relevant whatsoever to this kind of filing. So the bottom line is we have no authority or discretion whatsoever upon seeing any or all of the things I just mentioned to you to stop it. We're the filing cabinet for this kind of document, and we just do not have the authority to give anything a timeout or stop anything whatsoever. So it's problematic for people who want to close on a home or make other large purchases only to learn that they have these liens filed against them. And what happens? We do have a post-filing remedy, so we have to take in this filing. And if it's clearly bogus, then any of you who are victims of this more or less have to lawyer up at your own expense, and you have to go to court and get these liens removed. And that, more often than not, is what ends up having to happen. So this bill, House File 4042, gives our office the discretion to reject clearly fraudulent business filings. And in the event that someone believes that their filing was improperly rejected, maybe we made a mistake, maybe they used green ink and a red thumbprint, but it was all on the up and up, there would be a process in this bill to appeal that decision. Alternatively, if we miss a filing that was fraudulent, so that's the opposite end of the spectrum, if there was one that actually was and we didn't catch it, there is also a process in this bill for someone to have our office remove that filing too. I should say that 24 other states have this kind of pre-filing remedy, so we would be sort of the halfway tipping point, I suppose. 24 other states already have this, and a growing number are as well. And one reason, members, why I think it's particularly timely here is because we don't have one, and a growing number of states do have one, we are starting to become somewhat of a target for these fraudulent business filings. So, for example, we're seeing an increase in filings from offenders and inmates in Washington State coming to Minnesota. Why? Washington State has such a law. We don't yet. So we'd like to cut down on this fraud, not just for the efficiency of our office, but for the victims. And we want to relieve this burden for everyday citizens, and that's what this bill does. Also, it would certainly, as a byproduct, help our office run more efficiently. It takes a lot of time and attention to deal with these bogus filings. time and attention that could be best served serving your constituents who are law-abiding and obeying the rules. If we didn't have to file these documents, staff wouldn't be required to review these fraudulent filings, and normal business could take place. So that's it in a nutshell. I have with me to answer any technical questions on the bill or how this would actually work or how it's worked in another state. I have BB Black, our general counsel since 1981. She is a walking, talking encyclopedia about all matters pertaining to business law and particularly with our office. So I'll leave it in her capable hands. Thank you.
Thank you, Secretary Simon. Ms. Black, did you have a comment?
I just want to follow up briefly. Secretary Simon referred to the history. We do have a suite of remedies in current law in 545.05, 604.17, and 609.7475. Those sections were passed in 2006. Interestingly enough, when we came to not this committee, but a different committee in the House in 2006, turned out that several of the members of the committee had some of these bogus filings on them. I believe we have looked, and we don't have any bogus filings on any of you that we know of, that we were able to identify. But this is a real problem that affects not only legislators, but rank and file Minnesotans. The Secretary did a very good job of summarizing the bill, but I'll just say the bill provides the ability to identify and reject these bogus filings that appear to have no actual underlying financial relationship, a key requirement under the Uniform Commercial Code, Article 9. The text is based on language adopted by the Uniform Law Commissioners, who are the source of the Uniform Commercial Code, in response to this national occurrence of bogus filings. So after about 10 years of experience with these bogus filings under revised Article 9, which was changed in, revised Article 9 was passed in 2000 by the Minnesota legislature and nationally, and it took effect that year. And in the early 2000s, the Uniform Law Commission decided that even though they had previously not addressed bogus filings, they were aware of them, they didn't address it, and in fact they said in their commentary, we're not going to address it. They finally decided they had to do something. And so the bill that you have before you is essentially the text of what they did. When when a financing statement is submitted that appears bogus, the office of the Secretary of State under this bill may reject it. Even if a bogus filing is accepted because it's not readily apparent as bogus, the debtor has an administrative recourse with the office, which isn't currently available. They can file an affidavit to the effect that the filing was made with intent to harass. This starts a 20-day period at the end of which the filing would be terminated. At the same time, the office provides a notice of the impending termination to the secured party listed on the filing, and that party can ask for a further review of the transaction and submit documentation to prove up the underlying financial relationship, such as a contract or a loan agreement, which would be sufficient to show that underlying financial transaction. If the review shows that the transaction is there, the filing can be reinstated. Alternatively, the secured party has 6 months from the termination to commence a legal action in court to reinstate the filing. And I want to emphasize, this bill does not remove any party's rights to go to court, that's either the secured party or the debtor, on the transaction, nor does it interfere with these already existing remedies passed, as I said, in 2006. I could spend the next 5 or 10 minutes talking to you about the details of the bill, but you have a good bill summary before you, and the Secretary has also given you the thumbnail of that. So I'll take any questions that you might have at this time.
Thank you. Are there any questions from members? Seeing none, are there any members of the public wishing to testify as to this bill? Please come up to the microphone and state your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Paul Hodnefield. I'm Associate General Counsel for a company that is involved in the business filing and searching UCC records. And in that capacity, over the past several years, I've been involved in a number of aspects of that. I co-chair a task force for the American Bar Association on filing office operations and search logic, and I've worked with a number of states in implementing bogus filing remedies, both pre-filing remedies and post-filing remedies. And I want to speak about this law in particular. This, as was previously mentioned, it was developed by the Uniform Law Commission in response to growing state non-uniform attempts to deal with the fraudulent filing issue. And this particular bill strikes an important balance between the efficiency of the filing office and the reliability for filers and searchers in commercial transactions to be able to go in, be sure that their records are filed, be able to search them with reliable search results, and at the same time provide a very good and effective remedy for the filing office. There are several states that have essentially this bill in effect right now. And it has proven very effective, and it does strike that balance of giving the filing office the power to reject these records without interfering with legitimate transactions. So I wholeheartedly support this bill. I think it's good for Minnesota.
Thank you very much. Any further public members of the public wishing to testify? Seeing none, we'll move to member discussion. Any discussion as to the bill? Seeing none, Chair Halverson renews her motion to re-refer House File 4042 to Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform, Finance and Policy Division as amended. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion prevails. You're on your way.
Thank you.
And I believe the next bill on the agenda is my bill, so we'll switch places.
Welcome, Representative Stevenson. Would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move House File 3839 be re-referred to the Energy and Finance Division. And climate change. What?
3859.
Oh, 3859. Apparently, I need to get the number correctly. House File 3859 be referred to the Energy and Climate Change Policy and Finance Division.
Thank you for that motion. I don't see any amendments, so you may proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 3859 is a fairly straightforward bill. It changes a few reporting deadlines in a couple areas of law that it's necessary to move to better improve the functionality of the PUC and the Commerce Department, and I will allow Commissioner Kelly to maybe elaborate upon that.
Welcome to the committee, Commissioner. You can state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Halverson and members. I'm Steve Kelly, Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Commerce. I want to thank Representative Stevenson for authoring this very technical legislative report proposal. The bill has two provisions to change the due dates of reports that are submitted by the department. The first provision falls under the jurisdiction of the Energy Committee and addresses the timing of when we submit an energy transmission adequacy report. That's the reason it has to be re-referred. The provision of this bill that falls under the jurisdiction of the Commerce Committee is the date change to the Telecommunications Access Minnesota report. As members may recall, the TAM program provides equal access to the telecommunications network for people who are deaf, hard of hearing, speech disabled, or physically disabled, and includes both the Minnesota Relay and the Telephone Equipment Distribution Program. The current statute requires that the TAM annual report be filed by January 31st of each year with the Public Utilities Commission. Commerce proposes changing this due date to March 31st to reflect when the required information in the report is available to the department and the needed time to assemble the report. The report relies on information from outside sources, including the Department of Human Services and the telecommunications relay services provider, who is currently the Sprint company. We must provide, they must provide Commerce with the data by January 15th of each year. Since this report contains information for the previous calendar year, which we only get on the 15th, it's a challenge to file the report by the end of January. So we would appreciate the opportunity to change the date to March 1st, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that members may have.
Thank you for that explanation. Is there anybody else here from the public who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing no one, members, questions? Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering, why are we changing this date? And I know that the energy portion is probably best done in the Energy Committee, but I'm just wondering, with adding all of these new renewables onto the grid, why are we changing it to every other year and not every year of what's happening on the grid?
Commissioner Kelly.
Madam Chair and Representative O'Neill, the raw data is generated only every other year, not annually. So in submitting it annually, we essentially, on one of the, once each 2 years, we submit a report that says essentially the same thing as the previous report then.
Representative O'Neill.
Okay. Just really quickly, just, it's not the Energy Committee, because I'm trying to confine my comments, but maybe that should be every year as we move further and further down the road of doing lots of renewables. I know it's not the Energy Committee, but, you know, just we want people's light switches to turn on when they actually flip the switch. So just a thought moving forward.
Did you have a response, Commissioner?
Madam Chair and Representative O'Neill, the department shares your concern about reliability, and we think it is extremely important to make sure that we have adequate transmission, and we don't believe that changing the date of this report interferes with our substantive efforts to maintain or improve the quality of the transmission system that serves Minnesota.
Representative Mahoney.
When you're welcome to the committee, Commissioner, good to see you. When you change the dates on this, now I understand, I get the first half of this bill. But when you change from January 31st to March 1st, you cut down the ability for the legislature to digest the information and or to act on the information. So it's done in an odd year. Each year, but it's just old information. So that's my concern with this, and you say it's, you just correlate the information from other agencies. Why wouldn't you irritate another commissioner and tell them that they have to get theirs done sooner?
Commissioner Kelly.
Madam Chair.
No, I would.
Madam Chair and Representative Mahoney, the report, so the 2020 report relates to data generated in 2019. And January 15th is a reasonable time for those other agencies to gather that data and then submit it to us. And then we collate it from the Department of Human Services, from the telecommunications relay service provider. So we're coordinating data from several entities, not just another commissioner. So that would work better if we had additional time to do it. And we're hopeful that hope that the legislature would have time, if it desired to make change based on the data, that there would be time to review it with a March 1st deadline. I understand your concern with respect to that, but we think it's just practically better to be more thorough about gathering the data.
Representative Mahoney.
Yes. I still feel strong. I'll ask this question. The information you're being given, is that collected up until December 31st?
Commissioner Kelly.
Yes. It's through the end of the calendar year.
Representative Mahoney.
Well, again, I don't have any other questions. I just think you hinder the ability for the legislature to use it. And then a year later, we've kind of forgotten about the particular problem that was there, and it continues on as a problem, and no one ever does anything, and we're accused of being do-nothing politicians.
Madam Chair.
Commissioner Kelly.
Representative Mahoney, that is certainly not our intent to interfere with the legislature's processes. But I would also like to say that to the extent that the department, based on the data we gather, identifies a problem, we would certainly alert the legislature to a problem if we saw it, and we would not wait until the following calendar or following session in order to do that.
Any follow-up, Representative Mahoney? Thank you. Further discussion, members? Seeing no further discussion, any final words on your bill, Representative?
No, Madam Chair, I just renew my motion.
Representative Stevens renews his motion that House File 3859 be re-referred to the Energy and Climate Finance Policy Division. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you. Next up on the agenda, Representative Elkins with House File 3842. Well, welcome to the testifiers table. You can move your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We do have a delete everything amendment.
Okay. If you move your bill, and then we can take up your amendment.
So we'll move the move House File 3842 to the Committee on Judiciary and Civil Law.
Representative Elkins moves House File 3842 be referred to the Committee on Judiciary and Civil Law, and you have a DE amendment. Would you like to offer that?
We do, Madam Chair, and plus we have a typo that we'd like to correct with an oral amendment.
Okay, if you move the DE, move the, then we can do
move
your
the DE amendment.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay, Representative Elkins moves the DE amendment. And what is your oral amendment that you would like to make?
Yes, online
incorporation.
Yep. Yeah, Madam Chair, it's on line 13.28. It currently reads, a licensee with fewer than 25 employees is exempt from section 60A.9853. And it should read at the end 60A.951 and 952. So it, as it's currently written, it actually has the opposite intent of what's, no?
We're going to let Ms. Pompeo explain the amendment,
I think. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Chair and members, it's just a slightly different citation, so I want to make sure we get the okay. Right one. And so page 13, line 28, mm-hmm. We're going to delete everything after from and insert section 60A.9851 and 60A.9852 and a semicolon.
Thank you.
And a semicolon. So that is the motion. Are there questions about that motion? Does everybody have the reference? Thank you, Ms. Pompeo. All those in favor of the oral amendment to make that change as described by Ms. Pompeo, say aye.
Aye.
Any
aye.
Opposed? No. The motion prevails. And now we have in front of us the DE3 as an amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner Kelly will be presenting an explanation.
Oh, sir, we have to actually adopt the DE. We haven't adopted that yet.
Oh,
we amended
okay.
The amendment.
We had amended, okay.
We'll get everything right here. So,
Mm-hmm.
Representative Davids moves the DE3 amendment as amended. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. And now your bill is before us as amended.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, members, Steve Kelly, Commissioner of Minnesota Department of Commerce. Thank you for your consideration of this legislation and to Representative Elkins for serving as author of this bill that makes important updates to how the Commerce Department and our regulated industries work together to protect consumers' personal data. This bill brings forward the National Association of Insurance Commissioners Data Security Model Act. Over the past decade, there have been several data incidents at major but non-Minnesota-based insurance companies that have exposed sensitive personal information on millions of consumers. After nearly 2 years of work, the NAIC adopted this Model Act in 2017, and 8 states across the country have already adopted it. I'm happy to go through the bill in detail, but at a high level, the model has 3 main components for insurance and insurance producer licensees. One is have a plan for how you will deal with cybersecurity events, work that plan, and investigate cybersecurity events if they think one has occurred, and third, notify the state and consumers that a cybersecurity event has occurred. These 3 requirements will increase the likelihood that companies are prepared for the internal and external data threats they face, and that consumers can take immediate steps to protect themselves when private data is exposed. The department has worked collaboratively with stakeholders from the life insurance, property and casualty, and health insurance industries, as well as with Minnesota's independent and health insurance agents. The input from individual companies and Minnesota trade associations has been incorporated into the author's amendment that the committee has adopted. I thank all of them for working with us on this bill. With the passage of this bill, we have the opportunity to not only become the first state in the upper Midwest to enact these important consumer protections, but we'll also preserve the state's ability to act on behalf of Minnesotans with respect to their data security. One other point to note is that the U.S. Treasury Department has recommended prompt adoption of the model and has indicated that if states do not create uniform data security regulations before 2022, then preemptive federal action might be necessary. And so we, in part, are bringing this forward at this time in order to avoid the necessity of the federal government stepping in. With that, Madam Chair, Mr. Brickwetty is available to walk the committee through the bill to the extent that you would like him to do that, and we're happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Commissioner Kelly. And before we go to member questions, is there anybody else from the audience who wishes to be heard on this bill, for or against? Seeing no one, members. Mr. Brickwetty, are you providing testimony, or are you providing your phone a friend?
Madam Chair, here to help with questions and happy to walk through the DE3 amendment if members would like, but otherwise
he's a resource.
Absolutely. We'll be a resource. All right. Well, we're ready. Representative Spasinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question to the department. What of these requirements that we're putting into statute are not currently being done in the industry?
Commissioner Kelly.
Madam Chair and Representative Swedzinski, well, my hope is that all of them are currently being done by some entities in the industry. Our goal is to assure a degree of uniformity across the industry. I think that's the important reason for the legislature stepping in. I think responsible companies are already engaged in this, but we want to clarify what the expectations are in effect, set a floor for the conduct of insurance companies and insurance producers.
Any follow-up, representatives?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. So it sounds like a lot of the things that are in this bill are already being done by the industry, but your concern is, do we have actors that are not currently working under certain standards that would be kind of out of compliance with their current reporting standards?
Mr. Brickwetty.
Madam Chair, for the record, Peter Brickwetty, Assistant Commissioner at the Commerce Department, representative. I think the major portion of the bill that is not contemplated in current law is the reporting requirements for entities that are licensed to do business in the state. So there are, and as members will see in the DE amendment, there's a repealer that would remove 60A, 9H, 9A1, and 9A2 from current law, which is the current information security requirements for insurance licensees. But what is not in that current law is the notification concept that's contained in the NAIC model. And so to the extent that we have more than 250 Minnesotans who would be potentially affected by a cybersecurity incident involving a insurance licensee who is a non-domestic entity in Minnesota, so a non-Minnesota domiciled entity, we would receive notification at the state of that event so that we could help provide information to consumers faster and to make sure that they could take appropriate steps in order to protect themselves in the event that they were affected by a cybersecurity incident.
Thank you, Representative Swazinski. Additional member questions? Representative Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to probably Mr. Brickwitty, in reading the bill here, when you caught my attention, or Commissioner Kelly caught my attention when he said insurance companies and producers, but as I read further, it's producers with less than 10 employees. Producers with less than 10 employees are exempt. Is that correct?
Commissioner Kelly.
Madam Chair and Representative Davids, the DE3 amendment increased that number to 25 employees as the exemption level. So it would be, now I don't remember whether it's 25 or less, but anyway, yep. The Model Act says 10. In our conversations with the stakeholders, the department agreed that 25 would be an appropriate number to indicate. Now, I do want to say that from the point of view of the Minnesota consumer, if there's a data breach, they're just as hurt if they are working with a small-sized producer as they are with a producer of more than 25. But from the recognizing the practical challenges facing entities in terms of compliance with achieving data security, we thought that 25 was an appropriate cutoff. But from the point of view of the consumer, there's still risks that have to be recognized for if they are choosing to work with smaller producers.
Representative Davids.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the commissioner, and I certainly agree that it, but wouldn't you say that generally the breaches are from the companies and not the agencies?
Commissioner Kelly.
Madam Chair and Representative Davids, certainly the ones that have achieved recognition in the media have been particularly with larger companies. If you think about this from an attacker's point of view, the payoff of getting into a larger organization is certainly greater because you get a larger pile of data that you get to take out. But that doesn't, I think the reality today is that everybody is potentially under attack, and that after the hackers and other organizations that engage in this activity, after they've hopefully hit a wall with some of the larger and better resourced organizations, it's a risk that they'll go after smaller organizations. And what we are asking, one of the key elements of this language is that organizations do a risk assessment appropriate to the risks they face, and then be prepared to act on that risk assessment, and if they are attacked and there is a data breach, to report on that data to the consumer and to the department.
Representative Davis.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and this is very timely. I'm going through this right now with one of the companies I represent. I've got like 150 companies, but one of them, all the clients, we just got letters saying this happened like this, and you know, sign up with Experian or Equifax or whoever, just to monitor things. I think we got it under control, but they reported immediately and they did the right thing, and I think this bill is a very good idea.
Thank you, Representative Davids. Representative O'Driscoll.
Madam Chair, to the Commissioner, Mr. Brickwitty, is there any requirements in order for domestic, foreign, or alien carriers to get a certificate of authority in the state of Minnesota that they have to provide proof of a certain level of data security before that certificate is issued?
Mr. Brickwitty.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, I'm glancing towards our Deputy Commissioner for Insurance, who's in the audience, who's shaking her head no. I think, as I mentioned earlier, the current Minnesota law that's in the repealer, 60A.98 through 982, is a requirement of insurance licensees, including producers, in Minnesota law now. But I do not believe it is a requirement on the front end in order to receive a certificate of authority to do business in the state.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then the only other question I have at this time, I see we may have some other testifiers who, given the conversation, may want to come forward, so I will certainly make this quick. 25 employees, are we differentiating in the bill that they are licensed producers, or are they licensed producers and unlicensed support staff that might be in an agency or other adjunct organization to support the causes of the insurance companies?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Brickwitty.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, the language of the bill is employees. The discussion has not been, with stakeholders, has not been specific to differentiate between the number of producers or other entities. I think one of the challenges in crafting this law or translating the NAIC model into Minnesotan is that the NAIC was primarily, I think, focused on insurance companies, not necessarily on producers. But there are a number of insurance companies, particularly in our farm mutual industry, that also are in and around this threshold for employees. And so I think we've left the language to be employees of the company, which, as the commissioner was saying earlier, we think is a appropriate threshold, sort of delineating where a company may have the sophistication to likely already have a plan in place and would be able to take on this requirement and comply with Minnesota law.
Follow up, Representative O'Driscoll? We're good. Additional member discussion. And I know, Representative O'Driscoll, you asked if others wanted to testify. I did ask for public testimony, but if that wasn't heard and anybody needs to testify, by all means, not seeing anybody rush to the. Any final words on your bill, Representative Elkins?
No, Madam Chair.
Excellent. With that, Representative Elkins renews his motion that House File 3842 be re-referred to Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Division. Thank you very much. Oh, I'm sorry. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. I don't think it's fair that we have to be the last committee of the day sometimes. Next up on the agenda, Representative Katiza Watoon, House File 4055.
One bill's got to go down. Oh, not hers. What's she doing here?
Welcome to the committee. You can move your bill, Representative.
Madam Chair, I move that House File 4055 be re-referred to the General Register.
Representative Katiza Watoon moves House File 4055, and I see that you do have an amendment.
Yes.
You can move your A20 amendment.
Madam Chair, I move the A20 amendment just to get the bill in the shape that we would like.
Excellent. Representative Katiza Watoon moves the author's amendment, A20. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Thank you. Those opposed, no. The motion prevails, and your bill is in front of us as amended. You may proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 4055 is a technical housekeeping bill from the Department of Commerce, and Commissioner Kelly is here to speak to a variety of the pieces of the bill.
Well, welcome back, Commissioner Kelly.
Madam Chair, thank you for your accommodating hearing so many of our bills this afternoon. I'm Steve Kelly. I am the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Commerce. We also appreciate Representative Katiza Watoon's authoring the department's technical and housekeeping bill. This proposal makes technical changes, fix incorrect cross-references, and make statutory license requirements more uniform. This bill is meant to be non-controversial. We've indicated to the affected industries that if they have concerns, we will work with them to remove those provisions from the bill, and in fact, the amendment that Representative Katiza Watoon moved on was a reflection of just that commitment. So I will proceed with walking through the provisions that are in the bill now. Section 1 clarifies pledging requirements for national banks acting as fiduciaries in Minnesota This change aligns state codification with that of current federal law. This clarification will ensure national banks pledge an appropriate amount of investment with the Minnesota Guarantee Fund. Section 2-3 allows for the application of currency exchange licenses to be made through the nationwide multi-state licensing system and registry, which would ease the application process for Minnesota licensees. Section 4-5 clarifies the definition of a sales finance company in line with industry guidance, as well as modifies the branch location requirements to account more clearly for out-of-state branches. Section 6 aligns the definition of residential real estate with the definition used by the Federal SAFE Act. Section 7 aligns the definition of residential mortgage loan with the definition used by the Federal SAFE Act. Section 8 fixes an inconsistency between the surety bond requirements for individual mortgage originators that exist within current statute and clarifies that it is the mortgage company who holds the bond, not the responsibility of the individual licensee. Section 9 fixes inconsistencies between insurance statutes, as certificates of incorporation are no longer filed with the Secretary of State's office. Section 10 and 11 clarify the requirements for insurance companies to notify the department regarding changes in principal management and directors. Section 12 again fixes inconsistencies between insurance statutes, as plans of merger are also no longer filed with the Secretary of State's office. Section 13 aligns the timeline for financial interest disclosure when the principal in the transaction is a licensee or a relative or business associate of the licensee, as currently required. Section 14 through 18, these were changes for the statutes overseeing appraisers. These sections were removed in the author's amendment due to concerns from the industry. Section 19 requires the credit service organization to update their registration statement not later than 90 days after the date from which a change in the information occurs to not later than 30 days. This would be consistent with other licenses that we have. Section 20 amends the disclosure language for credit service organizations to be consistent with federal language. Section 21 repeals the no transmit list. This law was, as written, conflicts with a number of data privacy requirements, and in an effort to keep consumers from identifying information safe, the department has not enforced this law since it was enacted. Madam Chair and members, thank you for your time today. I hope you will agree that this is truly just a technical and housekeeping bill, but I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. You know, people think that what we work on in commerce is dry, but we are one of the funnest committees there is. So,
Madam Chair.
Representative Davids.
That was a page turner.
Appreciate you explaining the bill. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Are there any member questions about the bill? Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Commissioner, if you would join me, please, on page 9 of the bill. And I'm going to be referencing lines 9.24 through 9.26. And it's the additional language that you're suggesting to be incorporated. And that language has to do with providing the written disclosure if there's a financial interest or a relative or business associate of the licensee. Can you define for me, because it seems to be pretty open-ended, before negotiating or consummating any transaction? What does any transaction mean?
Commissioner Kelly.
Madam Chair and Representative O'Driscoll, I think the key piece here is that what was missing is the timing of when the disclosure had to be made in writing. What we're adding on 9.25 of the original bill, and what I haven't been able to do is get to the right place in the amendment, is that it was unclear when the written disclosure had to occur, and so here the emphasis is not on any transaction as being broad in sort of any transaction. It's before negotiating or consummating a transaction that's contemplated in A. I think you'll note that up in the existing law on 9.19, we say that before the negotiation or consummation of any transaction. So what we're doing here is making clear the timing of the disclosure.
Representative Davids, you had a comment to that point?
Yeah. Mr. Commissioner, what industry are we talking about in that section? Banking, insurance?
Commissioner Kelly. 82, Madam Chair, is Minnesota real estate licensing law.
Oh, we don't care about that.
I might know a thing or two about that, 82.68.
Representative O'Driscoll, did you have a follow-up?
Oh, sure, why not? Mr. Commissioner, so this talks about the purchase and sale. That was where my question came in. Is it conflicting when you talk about any transaction? What happens if I am a landlord and I want to lease? This isn't a purchase or sale, but any transaction. There could be, putting in statute, some confusion as to what transaction, any transaction means. I just a little concerned about the vagueness of that. Since in another life that I have, I'm very close to reviewing those types of provisions and statutes. So if you, looking for legislative intent so that if someone has a question at some point in the future, what does any mean? You've told us today that it ties back to the reference in subdivision two, part A, and that alone, not any other transaction that a licensee may engage in. Am I correct in that understanding?
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, that is my understanding.
Okay, I don't want the department to have more work and investigation than is necessary, but I also like to, again, go to legislative intent, so if there is a question that comes up, because, again, words like any, all, do have very broad, sweeping definitions, and I want to make sure that practitioners in regulated industries have the clarity they need to perform their duties. Thank you.
And Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, we agree with that, and I just note that the absence of this timing language was experienced by staff as a lack of clarity that made it harder to carry out their work.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Further member discussion? Seeing none, with that, Representative Katiza-Watun returns her motion to re-refer House File 4055 to the General Register. Re-refer House File 4055 as amended to the General Register. Words matter. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Representative. Next up, Representative O'Driscoll with House File 3576. Well,
you can play stump the panel. I'm good. Okay. I got into our 4 o'clock stop, Madam Chair. So.
Oh dear. Representative O'Driscoll, I understand that you have been working on this for a very long time and are continuing to work on it. So I understand that we're going to be laying this over, and you can make your motion.
That is exactly it. What I'd like to do is I'd like to brief the committee on where we are at on the status of this bill and talk to you about what we're looking at doing, and then if we can lay it over next week, we should have the final amendment, and it'll make a lot more sense when I get into the discussion on this. As I just previously discussed in our last bill, I have a lot of exposure to Minnesota's regulated industries, real estate, insurance, mortgage banking, and including appraisal. And I've been working with the folks in Minnesota on appraisal-related activities. And the bill that we have before us, there's general agreement on evaluations, and the person to my left, to the committee's right, Mr. Scott Vazio, will talk about those where there's agreement. And the person to my right, Mr. Byron Miller, will talk about continuing education and getting the courses that are approved in other states, getting approval for those in Minnesota without having to have practitioners take a second set of continuing education. And the reason for that is there's a regulation called USPAP, the Uniform Standards and Appraisal Practices, that are required in all federally regulated loans, that if you're originating a loan in the state of Minnesota or any of the other 49 states or territories, you have to follow these standards. So the course that is taken in one state that's approved should cover the standards necessary in Minnesota because it is a federal requirement. This bill simply says, along with us, with the other things that we're working on, maybe a longer list of classes that people could take under USPAP and other,
that are uniform, that taken in one state, if an applicant wants to apply for credit for that in Minnesota, the individual could do that without having to go through a provider of that education, because the standards are exactly the same, whether they're in Minnesota, Washington, New York, New Jersey, and I'll dispense with the other 46 states. You get the idea. Madam Chair, that is the gist of our bill, and I'll let the two gentlemen talk about the parts that they've been working on. Thank you.
Excellent. Well, welcome to the committee. You can introduce yourself and proceed.
Great. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Scott DiBiasio. I'm with the Appraisal Institute, and I'm going to cover the evaluations portion of this bill. Simply put, what this bill would do is allow Minnesota state-licensed and certified appraisers to provide evaluations, which is another valuation service that they're currently not permitted by law to provide. And you're probably asking what exactly an evaluation is in place of an appraisal. And what an evaluation is an estimate of market value of real estate that is provided to a federally regulated financial institution when that institution is not required to get an appraisal pursuant to federal law. And there's about five categories of transactions: residential transactions with a value less than $400,000, commercial real estate transactions with a value less than $500,000, and there's a few others, qualified business loans, some refinance transactions, so on and so forth. And for those transactions, they're not required to get a full appraisal, and instead they can substitute an evaluation, which is a much lesser scope of work for the appraiser to be able to complete. And under current Minnesota law, appraisers are not able to provide that service because an evaluation by definition is a valuation service that is not compliant with the uniform standards of professional appraisal practice. And an appraiser, in performing an appraisal, is required to comply with USPAP. So simply, this would change law and allow those appraisers to also be able to provide evaluations, which we think they are more than competent and qualified to be able to provide. And just so you know, evaluations are currently provided in the state right now by non-appraisers, whether they be brokers and salespeople, internal bank employees, in some cases accountants, in some cases architects, so on and so forth. So the appraiser really is at a regulatory disadvantage in that they cannot currently provide those services, and this bill would change the law to allow them to be able to provide that service. I appreciate the committee's time, and I'm more than happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your information. And next up, I just lost my list. Mr. Miller, you can introduce yourself and proceed.
Okay. Hi. Hello, everyone. My name is Byron Miller, and I am current president of the North Star chapter of the Appraisal Institute. Madam Chair and all representatives, thank you for your time. Actually, we are CE portion of this bill has to do with allowing, or originally, its original intent was to allow reciprocity of other appraisal-related courses that have been approved in other states to be approved by this the state of Minnesota, because currently Minnesota is one of the most difficult states to get continuing ed from a reciprocity point of view. From our discussion with our colleagues at the Department of Commerce, we have kind of morphed this into something that we think would be mutually agreeable to everyone in terms of we've identified a bunch of courses that are consistent throughout the United States and its territories that are the same. The education content is the same, and there is a oversight committee called the Appraisal Foundation. And one of their arms is the Appraisal Qualifications Board, which oversees all appraisal education throughout the United States. And they have a program called the Course Approval Program. And the Course Approval Program has a bunch of courses that have been vetted by them. Process is very rigorous, very similar to what Minnesota goes through. And what we are proposing now is that if a course has been approved through the CAP program, the Course Approval Program, then it would be allowed, accepted in the state of Minnesota. And with that, I would answer any questions anyone has. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. It does appear that Mr. Brickwood would like to comment on this as well.
Madam Chair, as Mr. Brickwood is making his way to the table if I could. Representative Davis may be asking this question, so I'll answer it in anticipation. This does not increase the CE requirements for appraisers. So just, if that's of help to you, Representative Davis.
Spoiler alert.
Madam Chair, for the record, again, Peter Brickwitty, Assistant Commissioner at the Commerce Department. Representative Davids, it also does not reduce the number of hours either, so just status quo. So, Madam Chair, thank you to Representative O'Driscoll and to you for laying this bill over to give us a little bit more time to see if we can come to an accord on this proposal. I think we are working with the appraisers on the continuing education credit language. I think we want to get that right. I think the appraisal industry and appraisers in Minnesota and across the country have a unique continuing education requirement set and have a unique set of federal standards that govern certain types of continuing education, particularly around USPAP, that appraisers have to take. And that content should be the same in Minnesota as it is in any other states. I think where we want to try to make sure we are not opening the door to courses that may not be currently approvable under Minnesota law is around the beyond USPAP, and so that's where we're in negotiations with here. So I appreciate the additional time so we can see if we can arrive at the proverbial peace in the valley on this bill, and happy to answer questions from
thank
members.
You for your testimony, Mr. Brickwitty. Representative O'Driscoll.
Madam Chair, well, Mr. Brickwitty is here. Mr. Brickwitty, I represented that the evaluations portion, there really isn't any concerns that the department had. I said stakeholders. I guess I'd like to, for the committee's benefit, make sure that what we need to have you and them continue to work on is what that list of continuing education classes would look like. That's kind of the whole of it, having the amendment and getting the bill through committee today. That's not a part that's at discussion or at on the table anymore. If I just want to make sure for the committee's benefit.
Mr. Brickwitty.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, the department is neutral on the evaluations component of the proposal. There may be others who might have thoughts on that, but the department at this time is neutral on that portion of the bill.
Thank you. All right, we've got 10 members on the list. I kid. Representative Tice.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative O'Driscoll. I'm very glad to hear that the evaluations are not performed by home inspectors, because I would think that would really be of interest to me if it was taking them out of the picture, as my husband's a home inspector. Secondly, I guess, is there any requirement of where all these out-of-state continuing ed credits can be? Because I'm feeling like there's Hawaii, Florida vacation in mind.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, Madam Chair, interestingly enough, and I'll let the department speak to this, but my experience is that classes that are approved for continuing education in the state of Minnesota have to be approved by the department prior to their being offered, but they can be offered anywhere in the United States and potentially even outside of the United States as long as they have met that approval process.
On a cruise.
But again, I will let the department speak to that.
May I speak to that?
Mr. Brickwitty.
Madam Chair. Representative O'Driscoll is correct. There is no barrier to a continuing education provider applying to the Commerce Department for course approval. Current Minnesota law requires that to be done prospectively prior to the course actually being offered, so that our staff can verify that the content is in compliance with Minnesota law and the course instructor is fluent in the subject that they're doing or that they're teaching in. So that courses that are held out of state are approvable and are frequently approved by the department. I think the question that this bill raises is what happens if you perhaps only have, say, one Minnesotan go out of state to Hawaii or elsewhere to that particular CE credit course, too, right? and does the continuing education provider want to take on that administrative responsibility to have a course approved for Minnesota credit when they only have one Minnesota licensee attending? Now, I think where we frequently see this happening is, you know, if there's a national conference where you may have a number of appraisers from all over the country and you may seek approval with regulators, some from, say, Florida or California or Texas, but not necessarily with Minnesota, because you may only have one or two Minnesotans going to that conference compared to 100 from California, Florida, Texas, something in that nature.
Thank you, Mr. Brickwood. Did you have a further comment, Mr. Miller, or did that cover it?
Pretty much. Sure.
Okay.
Yeah, okay.
Very good. Representative Tice.
Madam Chair and Mr. Dunwoody, I guess I'm really curious about this because we've been in a couple industries that require continuing education and do attend a lot of trade shows, and I'm really glad that the Department of Commerce is open to this, and I hope that we do see it, because that was one of the biggest complaints that we had, is that we would go to these national shows, do so many classes that were very similar to what they would have to do for continuing ed in Minnesota, but couldn't take any credit for it. So I do applaud the fact that you are thinking out of the box and allowing this, because it would be a lot easier to get credits, and maybe we wouldn't be so grumbly about it if it was, you know, worked a little bit more in what our time was, how our time was spent. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Tice. Any further member discussion?
No.
Seeing no further member discussion, seeing it affirmatively stated that there is no further member discussion, House File 3576 will be laid on the laid over. Do you have any final comments?
We'll be back in touch once we get the amendment. And again, we wanted to give a good background, so we came. We weren't taking more committee time, and we have the Peace in the Valley, as some like to refer to it on this committee.
Very good. Well, Chair. Appreciate your hard work on that. Members, Friday we are going to be here at 9 a.m. to take up 1,000 liquor bills and address our... And so look forward to seeing you all Friday morning. We will be finished by noon on Friday morning. With that, we are adjourned.
Yeah.